Welcome to the New Mexico News Podcast, headlines and stories from the land of enchantment. Brought to you by KRQE. Here's Chris McKee and Gabrielle Burkhart.
So we are in another windy spring season, and it's been 2 years since the largest, most destructive wildfire in New Mexico's history tore through the northern part of the state. That is the Hermit's Peak Calf Canyon wildfire, which you've heard us talk about a lot on the news and on this podcast. A quick recap for listeners, the Hermit's Peak fire started on April 6th, 2022, when the U.S. Forest Service had a prescribed burn that got out of control. That fire later merged with the Calf Canyon fire that started after a dormant Forest Service pile burn from years past rekindled. What's now known as the Hermit's Peak Calf Canyon wildfire burned through more than 340,000 acres, destroying hundreds of homes and displaced families who lost everything. So previously on this podcast, we've talked to FEMA representatives, that is Federal Emergency Management Agency, and a state representative with the Department of Homeland Security who's helping walk people through the claims process. You can listen to that full discussion if you go back in your feed. But today we're bringing in some guests who are on the other side of the disaster and part of a lawsuit against FEMA. Antonio Roybal Mack is a New Mexico attorney working with local clients in recovery efforts. She also has family property that was lost in the fire. And you're here with a client of yours, Pam Abreu, who lost her childhood home in Mora, as I understand. Thank you both for joining me.
Thank you. Thank you.
So first, broadly, let's start with you, Pam. How long has your family lived in northern New Mexico? And tell us what it was like growing up there.
We moved here from Iowa in 1957. I was a small child at that time. So all of my memories are of northern New Mexico. My father was a music professor at Highlands, but he always wanted to build something. So he acquired some land in Mora County early in the 60s and proceeded to build. And he went up there every chance he got when his classes were done at the university and built one cabin and then another cabin and then another cabin and a house and a shed and a workshop and had quite a compound before he passed away in 1986. And at the time that he passed away in 86, we had his to-do list. And one of the last things he said was, I thought I would live to be 150 based on the length of this list. So my husband and I proceeded to work on that list after he passed away, after my dad passed away, and keep the property up and take my mother up there and take our children up there. And then when COVID hit, we were so happy to have the property because the family could all go up there and be isolated. But all together, we had, by that time, we had a house and four cabins, and all of the property was utilized by my husband's family, which is a large family. So it was a heartbreaker when it burned because my parents had built it themselves.
Wow. And Antonia, how about you? Tell me your relationship with the area. Did you grow up there also, have family there?
Sure. I was born and raised in Mora, New Mexico. My family ranch is in Chacon. We believe the ranch has been in the family since 1875. My family left the Picuris sometime around 1870. And the next record is in Chacon around 1875. And that land has been in my family ever since. It was owned by my parents and, you know, it also perished in the fire. So I have been involved in this since the very first day the fire started and my parents evacuated to my home. So it's been it's hit home, literally hit home. The fire hit home with the work we're doing right now.
2 years ago when this fire started, let's go back to you, Pam. Where were you and your family? And when did you realize that your family home was in the path of the wildfire?
It's interesting because this is one of those things that you remember exactly where you were almost every day from April 6th till May 6th. So April 6th, when the fire started, I have a childhood friend. I call her a childhood friend. We're both in our mid-70s now. But we always have gone to look at fires. And she called me and she said, there's a fire burning out on 518. Let's go look. So we drove out just a little ways and we could see the plume of smoke. And it was so windy that day that I thought, who in the world would have had anything burning? And it was way too far off the road to think it was a cigarette tossed out or something, because you see that along I-25 where people are not cautious. I believe it was the next Monday, or perhaps about 10 days later, I picked up my granddaughter at school and was driving out towards Montezuma, New Mexico. And all of these fire trucks started passing us. And she said, Grandpam, is the fire getting close to the castle? Because she lives out at the United World College. And I said, no, honey, it's on the other side. I don't know where these trucks are going. But that was the start of the Calf Canyon fire. That was that day when they were starting to respond to that. My daughter had a newborn at the time, and the air quality in town was not good. And I said, you know, we probably need to think about leaving for the baby. Then I got a call from a friend who worked for Fish and Wildlife, and he was standing up at our place up at Murphy Lake. And he said, I'm concerned because I don't believe that they will defend this property. There's no way they would be trapped here. If the fire comes this way, you're going to lose this property. He was going around. Part of his job was to get people to leave. And he was glad we weren't up there. But it was unbelievable at that moment. So my husband and I snuck up there around the state police barricades, and we went a back way. There's a back way through the Rio La Casa to get up to Murphy Lake. And we went up there April 27th. It was very smoky. There was crews working up and down the valleys. There were helicopters, an occasional helicopter, not many because it was pretty windy. And we drove up to our place. And when I got out, I thought, this is too far away. The fire's too far away. It was smoky, but it had been smoky in town. And we grabbed a couple things, but not much. I called my adult children and said, what do you want me to save? You know, if this is our last trip, what would you want me to save? And my daughter said, save the Fisher-Price toys. And my son said, save the old Nintendo stuff. So we've always been a very playful family, I guess. But I, even that day, I took groceries up there because I thought, no, we'll be up here before long. Which, looking back on it, what was I thinking? I took groceries. And I took a picture of my husband as he was locking the house. Because I don't know why I did, but that was the last time. It burned that Sunday. I think that was a Wednesday or Thursday, and it burned on the 1st.
Wow.
And it burned very hot and very thoroughly. Some of the pro panel roof was right on top of the foundation. It burned so fast that it didn't even move. It just went down. All the buildings, all the trees, all the forest duff, all the bushes. I mean, every single thing was gone. We didn't get to go back up there till about May 17th. And I kept holding my breath thinking, well, maybe. But the same Fish and Wildlife friend called on the, I believe it was the 8th of May, and said, it's all gone. And I still was holding out hope.
But your family made it out okay?
Well, nobody lived up there permanently at that point. My parents have both passed away. And we had told the nieces and nephews and brother-in-laws and everybody, you know, we're not supposed to be up there, so don't go up there, because everybody was evacuated.
Got it.
So it was, 2 years later, I still can't talk about it without breaking up.
Yeah, it sounds like a really special place. Antonia, if you can briefly tell me, you know, what was it like for your family? You said your parents evacuated and moved in with you.
Yeah, my parents, my sister, my entire family moved over to Albuquerque. I was very much involved with helping with the evacuations, with helping people who stayed behind. So it was just a time of absolute, if I was sleeping 2 hours to 4 hours a night, it was a lot, because it was just helping. What do people need? How do we support the community? How do we get the broader community to get the support to the right places? So it was really horrific. Our neighbor, Miss Abetha, stayed behind because her husband was fighting the fire. And I kept asking her via Facebook, because we could Facebook message. There was no other service. You know, is the land still there? Is everything still there? And I knew it was gone when she didn't want to respond. She started responding with videos like, well, this is where it's at. And it was really clear that at this point, it was gone.
And Pam, where have you been staying since then?
Well, we have a house here in Las Vegas, and that's our primary home. The land that we lost up at Murphy Lake was everybody's retreat. I mean, it was where we all went. It's where we spent all of our time during COVID. And for my little granddaughters, they still don't understand. You know, when are we going to go to the cabin? There is no cabin.
So after this happened, the federal government, as we know, appropriated nearly $4 billion, that's with a B, to respond to the disaster. There's a local Hermit's Peak Calf Canyon claims office set up now in New Mexico to try and help people claim losses and rebuild. FEMA tells us hundreds of millions of dollars have already been paid out, but we also know some victims have had problems with the process. Antonia, can you tell us what's the main problem that you've been hearing about the whole claims process?
The claims process is disorganized, and they're not following New Mexico law despite Congress telling them to do so. So the biggest problem is FEMA has 180 days to pay claimants like the Abreos. The Abreos are far past the 180 days. That's a major problem. And really, we have bureaucrats in Washington, D.C., government lawyers really fighting New Mexico law. And it's not to the benefit of the claimants. It's to the benefit of the government.
So I have heard about that. We've seen dozens of lawsuits come out now. New Mexicans arguing FEMA has failed to meet the processing requirements under the 180-day mandated payment deadline, like you said. FEMA has told us that they've worked to streamline the process for victims. But Pam, for instance, tell me about your situation. How did it get past the 180 days for you? What's been the red tape, if you will?
Well, I count on my attorney, Antonia, to manage all of this. And it just, what it seems like from my viewpoint, because now I'm also working on some claims here in Las Vegas, because they opened up a way to apply for assistance even for Las Vegas properties. And in the time that I have done that, and I'm not using Antonia for that, because that was supposed to be a very simple, no muss, no fuss process, that has not been. So my personal experience with that is file saying that you have an intent to file. Then you get a letter from FEMA saying, we got it. We'll be getting in touch with you. If you have any questions, call this number. So I called the number after a month and got a recording. I kept calling the number, and one day someone answered. Never got a call back, even though I was leaving messages. That person said, well, someone will call you when they're ready to talk to you. So someone did call. I went down there, signed some forms. A couple weeks later, got another call saying those forms were wrong. I needed to sign some other forms. Could I prove it was my property? I said, I gave you the property. I mean, it's no matter what you do, there seems to be something else. Now, this last week, it has been, we've changed our process, or we have new information about how we're going to do this. So now we need you to sign this. So we sign it, scan it, send it back. 2 days later, get a phone call saying, oh, we've decided to use a different form because that form didn't. So it is one stumbling block after another. I'm a very patient person, so I just keep doing what they ask me to do. But the feeling is that they are not internally set on how they're going to do anything, what they need to do things, who's got what, who's working on what, who's answering calls, who's not answering calls, who can be approached, who can't be approached. You almost feel like some sort of criminal when you walk in there because there's an armed guard standing there. So it's not a comforting process for people who desperately need comforting. And my biggest concern, because I have relied on Antonia Roy and the Roybal Mack firm to take care of all the details of my huge loss. But I'm so concerned about all the people who aren't patient, who are out of their homes, who are living in garages, who are living in tents, who are living in with family, who are still in hotel rooms. And now FEMA said, well, we've put you up long enough. That help is going to end. Well, but you haven't come up with anything else. So it's frustrating personally, but it's also frustrating when you think about people who are so desperate for real, real help, and it hasn't happened.
Antonia, tell me what it's like from your perspective as the attorney handling these claims. Why is it going past the 180-day deadline in your view?
I think FEMA had a bad director. We don't know who the director is now. That issue was just resolved recently. They are getting bad legal advice, in my opinion. They're not following New Mexico law. So they have some, again, DC bureaucrats saying this is the way it should be in New Mexico. I think they are highly disorganized, and I don't think they're up to the task to distributing this money. This is not a government program. This is a settlement program. They burn these people's homes down, and they need to pay them for that. This is not an entitlement program where these people are getting some government benefit. And they're just not up to the task of doing that. They are having rapid fire hire events, which means they hire people on the spot. That's not, in my experience, the way you recruit the best people. And then by the time you train them, it's just too little too late. I do think they need somebody there's corporations that could come in and administer this process and have it done within 18 months. There's Brown and Greer. There's lots of corporations that do this, and they need to be opening to hiring one of those corporations. And they use a single email address, one email address for all the lawyers' clients to ask questions. I will send an email and wait 3 weeks and never get a response. Finally, in a FEMA meeting, I'll ask my question and get a response. So they are just highly disorganized. And could you imagine if your entire newsroom utilized one email address?
Yeah, that is very hard to imagine. So when you say they're not following New Mexico law, though, can you be more specific?
Certainly. One of the things they're doing is people are entitled to a lawyer. The act says you're entitled to a lawyer, and they are actively going around that lawyer-attorney relationship and, quite frankly, trying to get me out of the way. They are not paying non-economic damages. New Mexico law allows for trespass and non-economic damages. That means pain and suffering. That means all the things that people have suffered that you can't put a tangible dollar value to. And they are actually, even at this point, fighting us on our IOLTA attorney trust accounts. When a settlement, how settlements have been processed over my 17-year career is a certain way in New Mexico, and FEMA is now saying they won't do it that way. So they're just really creating these roadblocks that are unnecessary, and it's bad for the survivors, and it's bad for the process. And again, it's people not in New Mexico making these decisions for New Mexicans.
And I noticed on your website, when you talk about the wildfire relief, this is your attorney, Antonia Roybal Mack, attorney's website is what I'm referencing. It says, quote, "We know how impossible it is to place value on something that was not for sale." And that is a big piece of it, right? Because there's money available from the federal government to repay losses. But for a lot of people like Pam, you know, they probably would not have put a dollar amount on their property to begin with, right? What do you see as the biggest hurdle for folks who did lose everything and are waiting to be made whole in this situation?
The biggest hurdle is the federal government and their broken promises to these people. That is the hurdle we have, the way they're administering the claims process, their lack of communication, their lack of ability to communicate. I don't think it's intentional. I think they just don't have the ability to meet the need. I think that's a huge hurdle. And I also think, like I said, Pam's property, I probably asked her this because I asked every single one of my clients, what would you value your property at? And not a single one could give me a dollar value because it was never for sale. My family ranch was never for sale and it would have never been sold. Mm-hmm. I have 9 siblings. It could have lasted forever going through siblings. So really it's this idea that how do you value a generational loss? That's a huge problem.
For us, it was as if my parents were still alive because we had what they had built. And when it all burned, it was like someone killed my parents. I mean, that's in your heart. That's how it feels, is a whole new death, a whole new loss. And to put a dollar value on that is next to impossible. To put a dollar value on the time that you cherish together as a family, it's next to impossible. When you do start to put a dollar amount on it and someone says to you, well, can you prove that? Then that's when you turn to an attorney and say, can you prove that? Because I can't. I have no idea. So relying on an attorney for me has been for mental health as well as what I need done. Because I can't handle thinking about all this. For the people who have made contact with FEMA, if you talk to them on Monday, you may get a different answer if you talk to them again on Tuesday. And that is a huge problem because the people at FEMA don't know what the person in the next cubicle is doing. There is no solid information that you can get from FEMA and feel like it's actual information because it may change. And that's not the people who work there's fault. I'm not blaming the people that work at FEMA. I'm blaming the whole process because they're doing the best they can with limited training, limited expertise, limited understanding. And for some reason, they have instilled in the FEMA employees that treat it like it's their money. And it's not their money. It's money the government appropriated to make people whole. So it's not that they have to safeguard that it's being spent in the best way, or the safest way, or the most appropriate way. If my claim is for $1,000 and I say, I'm sure this is what it's for, write me a check. Don't make me justify it and re-justify it. And do I have photos? And do I have proof? And do I have this? And do I have that? And I'm an educated person. My husband's an educated person. My lawyer's the best lawyer around. And we still are wringing our hands.
And I do know, you know, when you have this amount of money, federal dollars, trying to be distributed, we saw this in the pandemic, right? I know there's a lot of concern around fraud and people that might take advantage of the system. And that's why we've been told, you know, from FEMA that they are trying to, you know, have those checks and balances in place so that the money does not go to somebody who really doesn't deserve it, right? But disaster relief, emergency management, we've seen coordinated efforts before after something like, you know, a hurricane, a big weather event. But I think this case is a little unique, not only because of how it started, but just the long-term effort that it's taking as well. You know, FEMA has hosted a lot of town halls. You know, they built an office now. Having them embedded, I guess, in the community, Pam, in your view, has that been helpful at all? Or what are those town halls like?
Propaganda.
And I'll add to that. You know, I would encourage you to come visit a town hall because it's FEMA celebrating what they believe is a celebration while people are still homeless. Nobody's celebrating. Nothing. There's no wins here. You know, even when Ms. Abreu gets the money that she deserves, it's not a win. It's just the best we could do with the situation that we were given. So, you know, they have a bell where if they write somebody a check, they ring the bell and it's a celebration. in the FEMA claims office. That's an embarrassment because there's nothing to celebrate here.
In the months after this government-sparked wildfire, I recall President Biden telling Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham, quote, "Governor, let me be clear. We will be here for you in response and recovery for as long as it takes. I know there's a local long-term office, like we've mentioned, set up, but there are also deadlines, right, in place for people to have to meet and file claims, right? Antonio, can you tell us what are the main deadlines, if you can give me some bullet points?
One of the deadlines that recently passed was the National Flood Insurance Policy Program that passed on April 1st of 2024. That was a FEMA mandated deadline. The act actually says something different. But the big deadline is November 14th, 2024, for somebody to file a notice of loss to say that they have losses. And I'd like to comment on something you said that, you know, FEMA is worried about the money getting in the wrong hands. Our clients are declaring under the penalty of perjury that they are not defrauding the government of the United States. Should somebody choose to defraud the government of the United States, we have the FBI and the U.S. attorney to go after those people to go get their money back. So they shouldn't punish Mr. Barreo and my client, Ms. Senna, and all these people who deserve the money because they're worried about fraud, because there's a mechanism for fraud. And by all means, for every single person that is taking a dime of this money they don't deserve, I hope they end up in federal prison.
The landscape also has changed drastically in northern New Mexico. We know it, you know, likely won't be the same for years. Do you see most people who live there trying to rebuild in the same area, or have a lot of them permanently relocated, you think?
I fundamentally believe my clientele, I can't speak for others, but for my clientele, I would say 95% are going to rebuild because, again, this land was never for sale. These are generational lands. And I know my family intends to rebuild. We don't intend to sell this land.
We intend to rebuild. And my little granddaughters right now have 25 baby pine trees on my front yard here in Las Vegas to reforest. And they water them and they love on them and they kept them protected all winter. And this is their idea of working towards rebuilding the land, is these 25 pine trees. 25 pine trees may or may not grow in that soil up there. I don't know. You know, the whole, what can you do? How are you going to do it? We still don't even have electricity up there yet. Morris San Miguel Electric Company hasn't been able to run lines up there. The rebuilding process is so slow. Thank heavens, because we don't have any money to do it with. If we had the money last year, maybe we could have found someone by now to start working on things. But that's the other thing, is if I was handed a check today, I'm going to be hard pressed to find someone to redig a well. The electric company can only get up there as fast as they can get up there. I need roads worked on. They've washed out with the flooding. I need some trees, more trees cut, because they're going to start falling down. It's been 2 years. So the process is mind-boggling.
And I know lawsuits can take a while to also make their way through the courts, right? We're talking about the slow wheels of government here. But high level, Antonio, what is the basis of your lawsuit and where is that process today?
The basis, one of the first is called a writ of mandamus, and that process is before Judge Browning. And that's kind of like an injunction. So we expect a relatively quick answer as to whether or not FEMA has to comply with that 180 days and what happens if they do not. So we expect an answer to that in over the summer, hopefully by May. The other lawsuits, this non-economic damages, that's not going to be fully briefed until the end of October. We expect that lawsuit to take years to decide, does Ms. Abreu get her pain and suffering for what's going on here? So those wheels of justice on the things that we cannot agree upon are going to be very slow, very tedious, and we're just never going to give up.
Pam, have you seen any funds recuperated from the federal government so far?
Not a penny.
Wow. And for someone who hasn't taken this path, you know, hasn't joined in a lawsuit, hasn't started the claims process yet, doesn't know where to start, maybe doesn't trust the government, maybe. I know there are people like that probably out there. Antonia, do you have any messages or advice for folks who may be in that camp?
First and foremost, the government does not deserve any of the benefit of the doubt on this. So they need to go in and file their notice of loss. They need to file a proof of loss. If you don't trust the government, get a lawyer. If you don't like my law firm, there's other law firms that are doing this kind of work here. There's one other local law firm. Hire a local law firm, I will tell you that. But definitely, they have to do something. If you do nothing, you will lose your claim. You will lose the benefit of this. That was not the intent of Congress. Do something.
Is there anything, I know there's probably so much to unpack here. You know, Pam is just one case of many that we know of, right? Is there anything else I'm missing that you want people to better understand about this process or that I didn't ask you all about?
From my perspective, everybody is entitled to be made whole because that is what the act said. That's what Congress agreed to do. When President Biden said he would be here as long as it takes, I don't know if he knew that FEMA was going to take quite so long. Because I think that they thought the ball was rolling back when he made that statement. So people need to understand you're not taking from anyone if you file a claim. You're entitled to that claim. There are people who say, well, my insurance paid me, so I guess I'll be good with that. But your insurance doesn't pay for your forest and your roads, and your insurance only pays a portion. Nobody is insured enough. And many people around here had no insurance because it had been in the family forever. It's mortgage companies that require insurance. So many people didn't even have insurance, which is a very sad thing. And so they feel like, well, I'm really out. Everybody's entitled. Go file a claim.
And I think I would just add that, you know, something you didn't ask about is I would add that I hope our congressional delegation listens to these sort of interviews, listens to people like Ms. Abreu, is not just listening to FEMA because they're only getting one side of the story. And I hope they do what they can do to pressure FEMA and to pressure President Biden to do the right thing here. And you made a promise and now they got to keep the promise.
Thank you both for joining me. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thanks again to Antonia Roybal-Mack and Pam Abreu, both with properties in Mora, that's northern New Mexico, lost in the Hermit's Peak Calf Canyon wildfire. Thanks for sharing your stories. Again, just to mention, we have had a FEMA representative on this podcast before, along with a state representative who are trying to work through some of the red tape and the challenges that we mentioned here. If you want to listen to that full discussion, just go back in your feed. You'll be able to find it. We'll also link to it in our show notes. If you have a story or someone you'd like to hear from on our podcast, feel free to reach out. I'm gabrielle.burkhardt@krqe.com via email and gbergnm on social media. Thank you all for listening.